Chronicles now transmitting.
Welcome to the Tate Chronicles on Healthcare Now Radio. And now, here's your host, Jim Tate.
Good day, citizens of the free world, from border to border, coast to coast, and to all the ships at sea. I bring you a warm welcome. This is your correspondent, Jim Tate, and thank you for tuning in to the Tate Chronicles. Join us as we cut through the fog that exists at the leading edge of healthcare technology. I'm really excited today. My guest is the one and only Mickey Tripathi, who's the former president and CEO of the Massachusetts eHealth Collaborative Organization, and now is the chief alliance officer at Arcadia. Mickey is a pioneer in healthcare IT interoperability, very active in the industry at a local and national level, and includes such things as membership on the board of directors of HL7, the Sequoia Project, and the Commonwealth Health Alliance, and as well as the HL7 Fire Foundation, and the project manager for the Argonaut Project, I was well aware of, which was an industry collaboration to accelerate the adoption of Fire. So, Mickey, welcome to the Tate Chronicles.
Great. Thanks, Jim. Really nice to join you on this. I'm looking forward to this.
Yeah, I am too. This the whole issue of interoperability, where we've been, where we are, and where we're going, is something that we have to keep discussing so we can kind of gain our footing once again. Now, I'd like to start off a little bit because I've become aware of the recent acquisition of the Massachusetts eHealth Collaborative by Arcadia and your new position there as the Chief Alliance Officer at Arcadia. Can you tell us a little bit about your new role there and where do you see population health data and analytics fitting into the healthcare landscape and the path for Arcadia going forward?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was with I was the founding CEO of the Massachusetts eHealth Collaborative back in 2004, where you know the world was very different back then in health IT, as I'm sure you and the other citizens of the free world who are listening will appreciate. And we were founded as a nonprofit organization to do a bunch of work in helping to understand, you know, what are some of the barriers to electronic health records, health information exchange, data analytics, and you know basically trying to be, you know, sort of at the leading edge and the bleeding edge of, you know, trying to figure out how, at least within Massachusetts, we might be able to get, you know, the industry to move forward with embracing this new technology. And that, that we did that for 15 years, much longer than any of us anticipated we'd be doing that. And then once we got, you know, to the end of that 15-year period, we started to recognize that, you know, that it probably didn't make sense for us to be continuing as a nonprofit organization anymore. It, you know, certainly made sense for a large number of years, but, you know, now as we look forward, we see that all of this stuff is getting moved out into the market as it's appropriate. And so that's when at the Massachusetts eHealth Collaborative, we decided that it made sense for us to transition the organization to into some bigger organization, but that we continue doing what we're doing, but as part of a different type of enterprise. And we've been working with Arcadia for years, both, you know, as a partner and a little bit as a competitor, but more often as a partner with some of the same customers. And that's how we, you know, decided that it made sense for us. So Arcadia didn't purchase the whole MassEHealth Collaborative, but they purchased some significant assets, and a number of the employees transitioned to Arcadia as well, including me. So I'm playing the role of the Chief Alliance Officer at Arcadia, which is a new position here. And what my role is focused on is, as the name implies, working on strategic alliances with, you know, with other partners in the industry that where we can get mutual benefit from working together to solve some of the problems related to interoperability, population health, health analytics to improve healthcare overall. I'm also, you know, one part of that role is continuing the work that I do at the industry level with the organizations that you described, HL7, Commonwealth, Sequoia Project, the Argonaut Project, Fire Foundation, and being able to, you know, sort of continue making the contributions that I've enjoyed making there and hopefully have been beneficial to those activities. And that also helps to bring to bear and help to inform those discussions with a lot of the real world experience that Arcadia has. We've been working in the population health space now for a number of years, and connect to a number of different EHR vendors and ACO organizations across the country. It's have a lot of experience in just the nitty-gritty of getting clinical data out of disparate systems, normalizing that data and trying to make sense of it and present it back to providers, payers, ACOs in ways that can help them improve what they want to do with respect to patient care.
Thanks for that introduction on that. I'm going to take about 10 steps back here, Mickey. And ask you,
sorry, I threw a lot out there.
No, I wanted all that, but I want to go back, you know, to the root of all this, which is how do you define healthcare data interoperability?
Yeah, so the way I define it, I think this is probably aligned with the IEEE, you know, definition somewhat, yes. Except I'll do it in lay terms, which is, you know, the ability of two different systems, meaning systems that are not made by the same vendor, to be able to send and consume information such that the users of one system are able to integrate that information and use it for whatever purposes they have. And I try to keep it, you know, that simple.
Yeah, right. And that certainly is the end goal. And you started, it sounds, back at 2004 or even earlier. And so the trajectory of back in 2004 or even earlier, to the definition that you just gave us, where do you think we are in that trajectory? Are we still 10 or 15 years away from mission accomplished, or is there a mission accomplished coming?
Yeah, no, I think that's a great you know, sort of nuance you've kind of put in there about, you know, is there a mission accomplished? Because, you know, one of the things that I guess I would say about that definition is, you know, if I was going to elaborate on it a little bit more, I tried to be careful in the way I frame that, because I don't see interoperability as, you know, kind of an on-off switch that, you know, we have interoperability, we don't have it now, and then someone flips a switch and then all of a sudden we have it. Because, you know, in going back to that definition that I had laid out there, it's about the ability to take information and use it for the purposes that you want to use it. And that could be, you know, different levels of sophistication of workflow and data, depending on what it is. So, you know, you may just have a communication need, for example, to just know that some particular thing happened to a patient, and that's all you need. Then you actually may just want to be able to read that or get notified of it, right? You have no higher expectations of it, and that's a pretty simple thing. It's like an email or like a notification. Like, you know, anyone, like most of us get from various websites or whatever it is, you know, we're doing, to just be able to get a notification that my patient showed up in the emergency department. That's a very lightweight thing. It's not something you're going to, you know, sort of do advanced AI on, or that you're going to build some huge research program on, but it serves a very specific need about being able to serve the patient, versus at the other end of the spectrum, having a very rich and full type of interoperability where I'm able to get, you know, what might constitute all or most of a patient's medical record from another place and be able to get it from multiple other places, be able to get it in a way that's normalized so that I can actually see that as one, you know, single longitudinal patient record, and be able to do a whole bunch of things on that, either as on an individual patient to be able to see what's going on with that patient, or be able to put that together for multiple patients and be able to start doing research and other kinds of things on it that'll benefit healthcare. So the reason I like to, you know, lay that out that way is that when we were saying before about that different definition of interoperability, there are different types of interoperability that we want to be able to have, and those will all coexist in the same way that we use, you know, email right now, and we use text, and we use Facebook, and we use Twitter, all for different purposes. We use Slack, and we use, you know, all sorts of other things in our day-to-day lives. I think of interoperability as being in that way too.
I see.
So getting to your question then about, you know, where are we? I think that, you know, it depends a little bit on how you sort of frame it. I think in many ways we're at a really good place with respect to interoperability. And the reason I say that is that that it wasn't that long ago, 5-6 years ago, really, if you look at the data, that more than half of providers in the country had an electronic health record. Right. And before then, when you look at those adoption curves that started with, you know, High Tech Act and the Meaningful Use Program, where the investments in the supply chain of Medicare and Medicaid started, that you started to see the slow adoption of electronic health records. And it really didn't cross the 50% point until something like 2013, 2014. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and the reason I like to point that out is we have to ask ourselves, I mean, you can't have a phone network if most people don't have phones, right? You can't have an ATM network if there aren't ATMs out there. And similarly, I would point out that, you know, it's hard to have meaningful interoperability if most people don't have electronic health records. They're trying to, you know, shove paper through the pipe. I mean, it's just not going to work. And so, you know, I start the clock ticking, you know, later than a lot of other people do to say, you know, this is really something that that we really could only really wrap our heads around meaningfully over the last 4 to 5 years. It's not, you know, that we should have figured it out 15 years ago any more than, you know, people should have been able to figure out phone networks before phones were invented. But, you know, be that as it may, now, you know, where are we with that? The reason I think that we're in a really good place is that if you look at what's going on with Commonwealth and Care Quality and Direct Trust, for example, different nationwide networks that are now starting to form, the participants in those networks, Commonwealth and Care Quality, for example, if you look at the EHR vendors that are connecting up their systems into that network, and they've already agreed to set them up. They're really now just in implementation mode. They make up something like 80% of the providers in the country. And so if you step back then for a second and you say, oh, okay, so in 2 years, we will have a network, a single network under this care quality framework, as they call it, where Jim Tate could travel anywhere in the country and 80 to 85% of the providers in the country would be able to query for your records and get those back into their system in near real time. And I would ask the question, is that nationwide interoperability? I mean, in some ways, most lay people would probably say, yeah, that's nationwide interoperability. That's my only expectation. I think others would say, well, that's not interoperability because those records are all a mess. It's really hard to integrate them. You know, they're not, it's hard to, you know, sort of normalize them. I can't put them into a research database. All of those things, and those are all true. But if you're saying, I just want to be able to solve that treatment problem mm-hmm. of being able to get those 4 or 5 records together because Jim showed up in the emergency department in San Francisco, then it will solve that problem, right? So we have different levels we need to think about. I would just say that for that first foundational level, we're in a really good place where what I just described is going to be in place in, you know, maybe 18 months.
Well, and that's, I guess, more or less what I might call the plumbing of the system. The plumbing will be there. You know, something that you said about adoption rates, I can remember in the early days of email, people said, why do I need an email address? None of my friends have an email address. And then probably in a 1 year period, you know, that was all history. It was amazing the adoption took place there. In my mind, there seems to be two major challenges, you may have more, to interoperability. One is the technical aspects. We'll get to the details of that in just a minute. The other is the cultural. Right now, very few providers will allow automatic data to flow into their database on the patient. They would be able to reconcile it, accept what they won't, not accept some things. So there's kind of that, because there's that, without having a national health system where everybody's looking at the same patient record, there's, you know, certainly some cultural issues in there. But one of the bigger technical issues has been, how does that interoperability actually take place now? You know, through HIEs, and I remember the early days of certification when EHRs would create a CCR or CCDA, and we thought that was going to be the answer to everything. And then it looks like that's all going to be surpassed by the FHIR standard. So could you give us a little tutorial on the FHIR standard, the place it takes in interoperability, and why it's important?
Yes, absolutely. So as you point out, I mean, the CCDA, I would say, is it's not that it's not good for anything. It's just that it's good for only some things. And that's the evolutionary nature of, you know, of interoperability. So Care Quality and Commonwealth and the eHealth Exchange and Direct Trust, all of these nationwide networks that, you know, those, the first three are query kinds of networks for me to query a record. Those are, you know, the basic unit of exchange in those networks right now is the CCDA. And Care Quality, I don't know if you saw it yesterday, announced the billionth record had been transacted over carat quality. Mm-hmm. So there's actually a lot of volume of data that's flowing over those networks now, and it's just going to be increasing. And to your point of people don't want to integrate the records, I think you're right. I think that has been a cultural barrier, but those barriers are falling fast, surprisingly, because the way those networks work right now. I mean, I described the paradigm of you show up in the emergency department in San Francisco or Los Angeles, let's say. I know you're from North Carolina. They want to query for your record. And it's sort of like a person in the loop. Oh, push the button, the records come back. Someone does something. But the way those systems actually work today is that what they're doing is every night they will like an Epic system or a Cerner system will actually look at who's coming in the next day on the schedule, and they will do a geofence search for every point on the network within a certain radius. And each of the vendors does it a little bit differently, but they'll basically say, what's Jim's home zip code and where is the site of care? And let me do a search of every point on the network, just a blast search, a query for records from each of those places. Mm-hmm. And then I'm going to bring that in overnight so that next day when the provider shows up, actually it'll say, there are five records here on this next patient. And then those are sort of staged. So you would see them as extra records that came in from the outside. The workflow, depending on which EHR, may not be perfect. But you actually could sort of, like an electronic filing cabinet, kind of look through them and say, oh, okay, here are the five records. And I can find out what I need to find. And then some of that data is parsable. And depending on the system, you're able to actually integrate it as data. So that's all happening today. So, it's not perfect by any means, but it is happening today. And they are, each of the vendors is thinking of different ways of being able to integrate that. What's the challenge with that right now? Well, the challenge, there's a couple of challenges. One is the CCDAs are it's basically a medical record summary that doesn't allow you to ask for a specific data element by itself. It requires that you get the whole CCDA. So in the case that, that we were just talking about, you show up in the emergency department, That emergency department physician, he or she may only want to know your medication allergies, right? That may be all they need to know for whatever it is, they need to do with you in that particular episode. And if they queried over care quality, for example, or Commonwealth, they would get back your entire CCDA. So it would not only have your medication allergies, it would have your entire problem list and whatever else is there in social history and all of that. And then they have to sift through all of that, either at a human level or a machine has to sift through all of that. That's obviously very inefficient. It's privacy revealing in ways that it doesn't have to be, because all they needed to know is your medication allergies. And it's just it's just got a lot of overhead related to it. So it's very imperfect. What FHIR does, as we think about FHIR and moving to a FHIR-based world, what does FHIR do? Well, one of the things that FHIR does just at that functional level is it allows me to query just for that medication allergy. So it allows you to say, I just want to know the medication allergy for Jim Tate. It allows you query those different systems for just that individual piece of data. So that can actually be pretty powerful. I mean, it seems like it's trivial, but when you start to think about millions and millions of records coming and the overhead of having to parse through all of that stuff, that from a technical perspective or a human perspective, becomes really cumbersome and inefficient. And we're talking about millions and millions of transactions a day across the country, you start to realize that, oh, if I could do that in a more of a refined surgical way, then I'm able to sort of really build much better workflows, much better ability to incorporate that into the workflows, and to it sort of reduces the cultural barriers as you would call them to be able to bring that data in from the outside.
If somebody retrieves from a health information exchange a CCDA, it's a file they get. FHIR data, is it in a file or some type of message?
So it comes through as, so one of the other differences between a CCDA and a FHIR, FHIR API, which I think is really beneficial, is that the CCDA is based on a set of healthcare standards that are really pretty unique to healthcare. It's the, the IHE profiles, which again, served many people, for pretty well for a long time, but it's a convention and approach that's very, healthcare specific when you think about SOAP transactions and the overhead related to that and the kind of, you know, sort of pipes that you have to build to be able to get that XML document, which is what a CCDA is, and then being able to parse it and all of that. And if you, you know, one of the barriers that we found to getting greater, you know, sort of usability of systems and greater adoption of systems is that because that's, you know, sort of relatively older standards that were literally created like in the 1980s, late 1980s, early 1990s, and are unique to healthcare, is there was very little, you know, sort of appetite for people outside of healthcare to jump in and say, hey, I want to build technology on that kind of, you know, sort of platform, right? There's no MIT or Stanford or Chapel Hill computer science grad in their right minds who would say, oh, I'm gonna sit down and read this 1,000-page implementation guide for a CCDA, right? Never in a million years would they do that. FHIR is based on what's called a RESTful API, which is a pattern that is very familiar to most people, even though they don't recognize it. Every time you're on Amazon, or Twitter or Facebook or anything else that you know that you consume over a browser today, that's a RESTful API. It's a way of one system querying another system using basically, you know, browser conventions and behind the scenes bringing that back as specific data elements and asking just for those data elements and bringing them back as those data elements back into your own host system. In the same way that if you go onto Amazon today and you click the button looking for a jacket, the data that you get back that says, here are the 10 jackets that, you know, that might meet your needs, and then you start to click through, every one of those is a query and a response, a query and a response. That's exactly how FHIR works, exactly how FHIR works. So it's a query and a response using that kind of technology. It places greater restrictions or expectations on the standardization of the data. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that's, you know, that's sort of a beauty of FHIR is that when you have another system that you query from and you get that data outlet back, you are going to understand what is the value set and what's the context of that data, because FHIR kind of requires that you do that in order to make it available for other systems.
The health information exchanges, correct me if I'm wrong, but they were kind of based that the CCDAs and files, DICOM images and lab files, things like that, were going to be the molecules that built up these HIEs. They'd be giant repositories. With the growth of FHIR, what's going to be the value of HIEs going forward? Are we still going to need them?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. I see it as, you know, sort of an independent question, because I think what we're going to see is, you know, is that these networks, whether it's the nationwide networks like Commonwealth and Care Quality, which in some ways are just national HIEs, or the state or regional HIEs, like, you know, like in New York and in Indianapolis and Cincinnati and, you know, lots of different places where there are local or state HIEs, there is one difference between the national ones and the state level ones is the national ones don't have a repository of information, whereas the state ones, as you point out, they sort of did have these building blocks or the molecules, as you call them, the CCDAs, to build a repository. But, you know, but all of them, regardless of what their architecture is, I think what we'll see is, you know, the FHIR is just a standard. It's just another standard. And so what they'll do, and the nationwide ones have already started doing this, and I think some of the state level ones are starting to think about this, like in New York, I know for a fact that they are starting to think about this, is they'll just add FHIR capabilities on top of the other capabilities they have, because it isn't as if, you know, these things disappear overnight. It isn't as if we're going to move from CCDAs or, you know, to FHIR and everyone will tear down their CCDA stuff. Just like every other technology we have, you know, the legacy technologies last for a while and they have a long tail. And so we'll start to see that as FHIR becomes more mature and more widely adopted in the industry, you'll start to see the networks, whether the nationwide or the state HIEs, will build in the FHIR capabilities. And then they'll start to use FHIR as well as CCDAs. And so they can accommodate those who can only do CCDAs. And they'll say, all right, well, we'll get that data as CCDAs because that's all you have. And for those who are able to do FHIR, they'll start to do FHIR. And then over time, you'll start to see the proportion shift. So it's more and more FHIR until FHIR is considered a new standard, an old standard, and you have the next sort of standard. The nationwide networks are already building FHIR into their capabilities. Commonwealth already has FHIR built into its core infrastructure. And Meditech actually is the one vendor right now who does pure FHIR transactions on the Commonwealth network. And Care Quality is, I'm the co-chair of the technical work group to bring fire implementation specifications into care quality. And, you know, we're going to finish up our work this summer with the expectation that that'll get implemented, you know, sometime over the next 12 to 15 months as well. So and that's already coming in the networks.
And now the ONC certification requirements, the fire standard is going to be part of that. I believe there's been some delays in that, or maybe the delays have been on the hospital abilities to generate some discharge information. I guess there were some deadlines for January 1st, 2021. They've been pushed out to July of 2021, but there are some regulatory timelines for fire.
There are some regulatory timelines. My understanding right now is that those timelines, you know, in the broad scheme of things, aren't going to be that big a deal. So, you know, I think they were pushing them out 3 to 6 months, for example, for, you know, for the rules to sure. clock to start ticking on when they had to have these implemented. So just so everyone understands, the rule that was a final rule said that they have to have fire capabilities in their systems, made available in their systems, according to a specification that they pointed to, that was based on the Argonaut Project implementation guide and, mm-hmm. and successors to it. And they had 24 months before they had to put those systems into the field. So even though the rule, you know, was effective, you know, just as of, you know, March or something like that, they had 24 months before they had to do it. So we still had, you know, a fair amount of time before, you know, before they were going to do that. Now, I think with the COVID crisis and everything, they've said they're going to push that out. I thought it was like 3 months, maybe it's 6 months. But my point is, it was already going to be 24 months.
I see.
So maybe now it's 27 or 30 months. You know, in the scheme of things, I don't know if that's that big a deal. I think the main point is that the rule didn't go away. And they didn't say, oh, we're going to delay it for 2 years.
Right.
So everyone who is starting to think about this, they still need to start thinking about it now.
Absolutely. They have time. Well, Mickey, I can't believe it, but our time's almost totally gone. how can our listeners find out more about Arcadia?
Arcadia.io. Oh,
there
you
go. Arcadia.io. Yeah, Arcadia.io. To our audience today, thanks for joining me on this episode of the Tate Chronicles. I offer a very special salute to my honored guest, Mr. Mickey Tripathi of Arcadia. Mickey, thanks for coming aboard today.
Thank you, Jim. Really enjoyed it.
You can find more information on this show's program page at healthcarenowradio.com. Until we meet again, here's wishing you smooth sailing and safe harbors.
Tate Chronicles transmission ending now.